Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Adam Briggle, who is Associate Professor of Philosophy and Religion at the University of North Texas. He's the author of A Rich Bioethics, co-author of Ethics and Science, An Introduction, and author of A Field Philosopher's Guide to Fracking. He recently had a joint article with the philosopher Robert Frodeman published in the New York Times entitled When Philosophy Lost Its Way, and this will be the topic of our discussion today. Hello, Adam. Welcome to the Middleway Society podcast.
Hi. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Okay. Well, I first contacted you because of the New York Times article, but I believe you also plan to come out with a book with Robert called Socrates Tenured, presumably which fleshes out the argument in a lot more detail from the New York Times article. What's behind the title of the book and what prompted you to write it?
Yeah, the New York Times article is kind of an excerpt from the book, pretty much similar to what we're going to call the prelude to the book, which hopefully will be out this fall with Roman and Littlefield, if we ever finish it. we keep sort of innovating and thinking of new ideas. So the title Socrates Tenured is to point out that the very founder of philosophy, Socrates, wouldn't get tenure in an academic department today. After all, he didn't really do much reading around the secondary literature, didn't write anything. But more than that, he didn't really spend his time talking to other academic philosophers. And so it turns for us into a critique of disciplinarity. And that's really the heart of the book, is we believe that philosophy never should have become an academic discipline, at least not a discipline that's solely absorbed in sort of talking to disciplinary peers, but rather should be an outward-looking enterprise, very much in the spirit of what Socrates practiced. So that's kind of the idea. And then the book is structured to kind of diagnose the problem. The first part does that. The second part looks at various attempts to kind of overcome the problem, including applied philosophy and bioethics. And then the last part is our idea of field philosophy, which we put forward as a novel model, a kind of non-disciplinary or post-disciplinary model of philosophy.
Okay, well, hopefully we can talk about some of that stuff as we go along. I'd be interested in this field philosophy. We can talk about that a bit later.
Sure.
Could we begin by maybe unpacking some of the ideas? So what are the various ways that the history of philosophy has normally been presented?
Oh, yeah. So that's another way to put this, is a kind of an alternative history of philosophy. You know, if you study the field, it's very typical. And I mean, even in our department, you tend to structure it as something like the pre-moderns or the ancients. And then maybe you have a medieval philosophy and then modern philosophy. And then you might tack postmodern philosophy at the end of that, feminism or something like that. What's missing in that story, and this is the way we try to frame it, I think, in that New York Times piece, is the late 19th, early 20th century disciplinization of philosophy within the realm of the research university. And, you know, philosophers have sort of not told that part of the story, I think, because they've taken that institutional shift to be sort of exogenous to the real stuff of philosophy. You know, it's just sort of creating the space within which the pure flower of philosophy can bloom, this sort of disciplinary enclave. But we think actually the disciplinization of philosophy became constitutive of its identity and sort of changed the standards and the very practice of what they were doing. But philosophers have been kind of blind to those institutional imperatives and how it's changed even the substance and theory of what they're up to.
Interesting. So how would then was philosophy normally pursued before it entered the university, before it became, as you say, a discipline?
Yeah, good question. I mean, the short answer is in a whole bunch of ways. You know, guys like John Locke, somebody I'm trying to read a little bit more about lately, is a good example. You know, he comes out of Oxford, but he has kind of a love-hate relationship with the institution. he finds it to be kind of stifling, and really spends most of his time philosophizing, if you will, in the informal Republic of Letters that takes shape around that time, working with folks at Exeter House down in London, traveling around France and cooking up his some of his major ideas in his epistemology, and then living in exile in Holland, you know, after getting sort of caught up with some seditious activities, you know. And then that's just one example, but you look at Descartes, similarly moving within the interstices of various organizations, various republics of letters. Marx, of course, is another good example. It's not really until Kant that you begin to have the idea of the philosopher as a specialist, as an academic. And, you know, it takes a while after he kind of writes down the theory of that to kind of become instantiated. But really by the early 20th century, you have guys like William James and John Dewey, the pragmatists, who are noticing the changes happening to philosophers, that they're becoming these sort of, as Nietzsche would call, screech owls, nook dwellers, just talking to their disciplinary peers, just sort of advancing the margins of arguments in an insular conversation. But this, beyond sort of Nietzsche and Dewey and James, there wasn't a whole lot of attention paid to this shift from a wide-ranging roaming conversation out and about in society to a kind of close, cloistered, insular disciplinary activity.
Sure, yeah. And I'm also thinking of the ancient Greeks, you know, especially the Hellenic philosophers. They arguably saw philosophy as something you did, a practice. You know, if you look at the origin of the word, it's being a friend of wisdom, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think to a wide extent that's true, certainly of Socrates. You know, I mean, with Aristotle, there may be a little bit more of a sense that this theorizing is something reserved for maybe only the few, and Plato might say that as well.
I suppose I'm thinking of people like Epicurus and Pyrrho.
Yeah, yeah. I guess there's differences on that, but I think that, yeah, you're right. The broader point is that there's kind of an engagement with the polis, with social issues built into the heart of philosophy. And even Aristotle, who might be a bit more reserved and who's kind of allowed into philosophizing, he's very clear that the point of philosophy, especially his practical sciences, the ethics and politics, is to lead a better life. I mean, it's to lead a good life. And that sort of orientation towards being good, being virtuous, is the other casualty of becoming another specialty. You become kind of a knowledge worker, and that knowledge becomes divorced from any sense of developing your character or developing the character of people that you talk with.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So philosophers became experts, and this obviously, as you say, runs counter to the more Socratic, skeptical approach to philosophy, which, you know, is arguably more about exploring the limitations of our knowledge. To me, this also brings to mind a quote by Wilfred Sellers, and he says, "It's the task of philosophy to determine how things in the broadest sense of the word fit together in the broadest sense of the word." To what degree do you think philosophy is also about seeing the bigger picture? That is, it's as much about thinking synthetically as it is about thinking analytically.
Oh, I very much think so. That's a big remit, it should be, of the philosopher, to see how things hang together. I like that quote. You know, but I think what happened was that was sacrificed, that sort of role was sacrificed there at the founding of the modern research university with its logic of specialization, because it really does put you into a stovepipe next to other stovepipes, and you become what Heidegger would call a regional ontology, focused on just the issues within your domain and bracketing them off artificially from the things surrounding it. And it really becomes a laboratory model of science. You know, disciplinary philosophy is like a lab science. It operates within these artificially constructed confines. And yeah, you're right. What you lose then as a result is what are the wider connections. That's why we actually coined the term field philosophy. I mean, Bob again is the one who's really done the thinking on this, but field sciences are not like lab sciences. They go out into the world and try to deal with the way the natural world is unfolding in situ, you know, like with all the messiness involved. And that's the same with field philosophy, is that if we're going to see how things hang together, we're going to have to deal with stuff that is not really philosophical because it's all mashed up together. So we're going to have to learn something about whatever the project is. It's engineering or science or a public policy or an economic policy, because the philosophic dimensions, just like geological strata, are going to be sort of interlaced and interstitial with all that other stuff.
So you'd like to see philosophy become, how should I express this, practical again, rather than just focusing on abstraction.
Yeah, we struggle with what term exactly are we talking. Is it practical? I guess that's kind of what we mean. We one of the things we did is went back to look at Adam Smith, who talks about productive and unproductive labor. And we have, I think, a nice section in the book where we try to tease this out. Smith actually says unproductive labor, which means that's sort of lost in the moment, in its very execution. You know, it doesn't store things up to be used later. That's productive labor. Productive labor is the sort of fund, he says, of our national wealth. And unproductive labor, in a way, draws down that fund. But he has very high regard, actually, for a lot of unproductive labor. He says soldiers, I like this, soldiers are unproductive laborers, because when they're defending the country, you can't, like, take last year's service in defense and just use it this year, you know. The defense is sort of vanished in the moment it's done. Philosophers, I think, in a way, are unproductive laborers.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean they're useless,
no.
You know? I mean, that's the sort of thing we're wrestling with in this book.
Well, Socrates is a classic example of that. If that society didn't have a certain degree of affluence, then it couldn't support people that are allowed to just go around and think. But we need people to be able to do that, surely.
Sure. I mean, yeah, what is all this productive labor for? just more productivity? I just watched Josh Fox's new film last night about climate change, and he did a really good job of showing that this is all of what we're doing to the planet is driven by our desires.
Yeah.
You know, we do not know how to manage desire. And it's fundamentally a philosophical issue. Of course, the word philosophy never comes out of his lips in the film, which is okay. Actually, I think what we need to do is recognize it as it comes, even when it's not labeled as such.
Yeah. Okay. This process, what happened to philosophy? You've used the term purified at times. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. In fact, I think initially we called that piece Philosophy Purified. This is a kind of a reference to Bruno Latour, who is a anthropologist, a science, technology, society scholar. And Latour has a great little book called We Have Never Been Modern. And what he means by that is that he said what we think modernity means is creating these categories and putting things into different buckets, and in that sense purifying them. You know, Kant is a great artist of, you know, there's autonomous things and there's heteronomous things, right? And there's a bucket for each one. And we think, you know, as moderns, that there's a bucket for economics, and there's a bucket for science, and there's one for technology, and there's another one for the humanities, and everything has its proper place. But what Latour says, it's kind of like that Hegelian point earlier, is that as we go about in our modern lifestyles, we mangle and tangle and hybridize all those things and mix them all up. So we have never been modern. We thought we were, like, creating these separate categories, but actually, in all of our activities, we smush all that stuff together. And that's the kind of trope we use with philosophy, is that we've attempted to purify it. And in some sense, unfortunately, we succeeded, you know, by cloistering it off in the university as a discipline. But in reality, like I was saying with this climate change film, philosophy is feral. We're doomed to philosophize. You know, it's always going to be sort of shot throughout our issues. And really, our book is a kind of a cri de coeur, a kind of a call to arms for academic philosophers to get in the mix and help society think through those issues.
Okay. And then also, arguably what happened was something you talked about was the divorcing of knowledge from virtue. These at one time were seen as interdependent. What happened there? Was it part of the same process?
Yeah, it's this is a point I owe to Stephen Shapin, another kind of science studies scholar. in a book called The Scientific Life. And he makes a claim that what happened, again, late 19th, early 20th century with science is you had the development of the moral equivalence of the scientist, which is before that, the assumption was that if you're studying nature, whether it's understood as just the physical forces inherent in things or the book of God, there was something kind of ennobling about that, and it improved your character, and knowledge and virtue were tied together, and knowledge made you a better person. That is part of what was lost with specialization in the research university. Scientists become knowledge workers. They become bureaucrats in a sense. They're sort of put into a Fordist system along this sort of chain of production. And they are then on tap, as it were, sort of tools or instruments to be used for whatever powers that be, whether it's capitalist or communist or a private employer or a public employer. You know, there's a good line out of a satirical song about Wernher von Braun, who was a Nazi rocket scientist who made the V2 rocket, which was used to kill so many people in London during the bombings in World War II. And Tom Lehrer wrote a great song, and one of the lines is, the rockets go up, and who knows where they come down? That's not my department, says Wernher von Braun. Right? That, as in, hey, all I do is produce knowledge. And how it's tied to morality or politics is none of my business. You know, I just get my paycheck for doing good stuff as judged by my disciplinary peers. And what the wider world makes of it is, you know, beyond my remit. And that happened to, in that sense, philosophy is oh so scientific. That's the same way we think is, hey, we publish our papers. If my peers like them, then they get put into journals, and then I get it on my CV, and then I get my paycheck, and I get my tenure. Whether this is doing any good for society, well, you know, that's for somebody else to figure out. Right? That's not part of my job. Well, in that sense, what we're arguing is, yeah, it is. And you need to expand your job description if you're an academic philosopher. It's another way of kind of putting our point.
Do you think this also might have something to do with the pervasiveness of the fact-value distinction that you know, that you find in science and philosophy, that in science that, you know, you deal with facts and they are completely objective, as you were saying, that, you know, that scientists have that, you have this idea of objectivity that's almost like a god's eye view of things. Then there's this sort of dualism then that values are only subjective. Now lots of research with neuroscience and psychology showing that this distinction between reason and emotion and facts and values is debunked to a large extent. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I totally agree. I think the fact-value dichotomy is perhaps the thing that has wreaked the most havoc on our moral psychology, on our political social existence. The presumption that somehow there are these two purified, again, right, things, facts and values, that we can divorce. You know, I think on the margins, that may hold, right, on the extremes.
Yeah.
But I think most of our lives happen somewhere along a continuum where those things are mixed up, you know, and it doesn't make sense. You can just think about thick moral concepts like cruelty, for example. I mean, if somebody's acting cruel, that's both descriptive and prescriptive simultaneously.
Yeah.
And so much of our moral lives, our political lives, is along that continuum. So, yeah, I mean, I think that dichotomy is destructive, very much, and it's unfortunately just pounded into our children that, you know, there are these facts and then there are these values. And then that becomes, I think, corrosive for our public discourse, because we don't know how to engage in a reasoned, debate about, let's call them fact-value hybrids.
Yeah.
Because you're either just shouting at each other, assuming that all I'm doing is emoting all over you and whoever shouts loudest will win, or you're appealing to science as if somehow that is some neutral fact or value neutral realm that will compel the right decision just because it will be like self-evident from the facts. I mean, both of those strategies are nonsensical, but they're employed all the time.
Yeah, no, I entirely agree there, Adam. So what's the state of philosophy in the West today? What do most philosophers aspire to be?
Well, it depends on what you mean by a philosopher. I mean, We're trying to be careful with, you know, I think there's philosopher in the sense of one who is noble in soul and in who seeks to let the truth shine. And that can be anybody, you know, who has achieved a certain greatness of self. But if you're talking about academic philosophers, you know, that's something we're trying to get a hold of, is we're trying to do a kind of sociology of academic philosophy. And I mean, in rough outlines, we think there's something like a mainstream, which is still disciplinary in orientation. And that's kind of an orthodox philosophy. And what those orthodox philosophers want to do is talk to other disciplinary peers and have that recognized on their curriculum vitae. And, but there is also this growing heterodox, sort of half self-conscious, very murky, Reformation movement going on. And, you know, it goes by different names, public philosophy, maybe sometimes experimental philosophy. We call, you know, our little funky brand field philosophy. There's a group that does kind of a philosophy within science and engineering. And it's not clear, you know, it's neat. A lot of the stuff they're doing is very cool. And some of it breaks what we call the disciplinary stranglehold on orthodox philosophy. But it's not very self-conscious. And as a result, it kind of remains a bunch of one-off attempts rather than a kind of self-aware institutional reaction and that would become a kind of a legitimate form of philosophy in its own right. So one of the tasks in our book is to really name this heterodox group and help it to achieve greater self-awareness so that it can build itself into a legitimate enterprise and not just remain a bunch of goofballs on the margins, you know.
Well, it sounds fascinating, Adam. I look forward to reading it. But I'd be interested in, could you just give us a quick overview then of what field philosophy is?
I think field philosophy, the key to it is audience, you know, and that's what disciplines assume, an audience of fellow adepts, of fellow experts. Field philosophy flips that on its head. Where you begin is with a real world problem as it is being contested and defined out in the world. So it happens on a meso level, which is to say, we're not talking about, for important as it is, we're not really talking about philosophical counseling with individuals or with families. And we're not, so that's kind of micro level, and we're not talking macro level like philosopher king stuff, like reforming entire societies. We're talking meso level. So in the book I wrote about fracking is a good example. You got a municipal policy at stake where you have an industrial land use and competing interests that are both economic and public health and sort of quality of life. And you begin to just try to learn about the issue, and you're working with stakeholders who are non-philosophers. You know, they're the mayor and city council, and they're industry members, and they're folks living in neighborhoods, and they're scientists who are involved, and engineers who are doing studies about this stuff. And you just try to figure out, you know, you're exercising your judgment. You try to figure out, what's my value added? You know, qua philosopher, what are the philosophical dimensions here that are either being poorly articulated or assumed, or the arguments have flaws in them, or whatever it may be. You know, there's philosophical stuff lurking in there, and you're trying to find, as a field philosopher, how you can excavate that and help a community stakeholders think through a real-world decision in real time. You know, that's the other part of field philosophy, is you're actually cashing out your value, if you will, right there in real time. You're not sort of, and this is what we call the centripetal model of, this is different than applied philosophy. I want to stress that. Applied philosophy is kind of centripetal. You might go out and into the field and gather up some stuff, but then you return back into the disciplinary fold and you publish what you learned about in a disciplinary applied philosophy journal that's not read by anybody who's out there in the field who might have benefited from your knowledge, you know? So even applied philosophy suffers from what we call disciplinary capture. And field philosophy really is like about co-production of knowledge in real time with community stakeholders.
Could another term be perhaps integrated in the sense that it has both a sort of conceptual side to it, but a practical side.
Yeah, I mean, very much. This is a sort of theoretical point about epistemology, for example, about what is knowledge, what will count as knowledge. You know, when I talk in a coffee shop with a city councilor and we're running over some ideas, there's knowledge in there, right?
Yeah.
That's sort of co-produced through a conversation. And again, we're back to sort of Socrates, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's theoretical elements, but there's also very practical elements about how do you incentivize philosophers to do this kind of work when our metrics for excellence are traditional bibliometrics of peer-reviewed citations. You know, we have to think about revising promotion and tenure criteria, revising the way we train graduate students to kind of acquire the skills involved for this. So, yeah, it's a mix of conceptual and practical points.
Well, to round up, Adam, could I just throw you a few questions that potentially to explore how, you know, an effective philosophy could and should be?
All right, you can shoot away, sure.
Yeah, okay. Well, should philosophy be about questioning all our assumptions?
Well, you know, it's hard to make blanket assertions like that. I think in general, philosophy is about questioning assumptions. But in book one of The Republic, it's kind of a prior question about, in any given situation, how much philosophy can it stand or should it stand? And you may be in a position where you have to act quickly, and questioning assumptions in that situation may not be the right thing to do.
Sure.
So, yes, in general, I guess is my short answer.
Yeah, yeah, but I suppose with that classic example of if you're on the, you know, on the railway and there are five people and you turn the wheel to kill one or five, then you're not going to be doing much philosophizing at that point, are you?
Yeah, I mean, there are the demands sometimes of timeliness, right?
Yeah. Okay. Next question: would you like it to be an aspect of everyone's lives?
Philosophy?
Yeah.
Oh, whether I want it or not, it is. You know, this is something that makes philosophy different from biology or chemistry. I mean, yes, in a sense, we're all biochemical beings, but we don't have to think about that, you know, consciously. Your heart just beats. But we do have to be philosophers, you know, more or less skillfully, more or less consciously, but we all inevitably have to make choices about how to treat our friends, right? What to do with our own mortality. And how to face that in our lives, or you name it. You know, we're always thinking thoughts about that are aesthetic, that are moral, that are epistemological. It's unavoidable. You know,
yeah.
We're doomed to philosophize.
But I imagine that you've been in many discussions with people when, just at the point when it starts to get interesting, people often say, "Hey, listen, I'm not a philosopher." There's this assumption by many people that you have to be some sort of expert.
Well, you know, in some sense, there is a case to be made for, I guess, a modest form of philosophical expertise, just in the sense that folks who get paid to do this have the background and have the training and have the time and the leisure to think through stuff. So, you know, in a way, there's legitimacy to that point. But that's often also kind of a cop-out to say, I'm just tired of thinking, you know. And really, I've got my mind made up, and you're raising questions that are getting at these assumptions I'm making that I just don't want to dig up. And that's, I think, when it becomes problematic.
Sure. Okay. I think we've sort of covered this, but should philosophy also take psychology and neuroscience seriously?
Probably, yes. I mean, in general, I think there is a case to be made that you have to be aware of what the other sciences are up to, especially if they're digging up stuff that A, either points to philosophical questions, or B, challenges longstanding philosophical assumptions about the way we think, for example, or something like that. So it is important to be aware of that.
Okay. Well, what about it encouraging us to see our limitations and viewing things more provisionally?
Yeah, I mean, that's another way to talk about Socrates, is the one, you know, outside of Eros, you know, he said he wasn't an expert in anything. You know, that if I'm the wise man, it's only because I know I don't know.
Yeah.
And I do like that. It's maybe something we should, you know, you're going to get me in trouble because now we're thinking of all these ideas I should put in the book, which is going to delay it more. But to sort of highlight this humility at the origins of philosophy, that you are standing in wonder at forces that are greater than you and at complexities that you can't understand. And there's a certain kind of attitude that one ought to adopt in the face of that. Yeah, that's true.
Okay, and then it is a big question. Should it also help us to take responsibility for our values rather than just seeing them as arbitrary?
Oh, that's a good question. I suppose those aren't really the only two choices. I mean, your values are maybe inculcated via traditions and upbringing and all of that, so it's not particularly arbitrary, but they may not be of your own doing. In a sense that you're the author of everything about your own identity or life. So I guess, though, if you're talking about, I guess I see where you're going. Yeah, if once you start thinking and you start knowing more about the assumptions you make, the values you have, you can't, I think the responsibility is to not unknow that, you know, like the Simpsons cartoon where Homer, it becomes enlightened and then he decides to sort of forget all that and shove a crayon up his nose to damage his brain so he can go back to the idiot that he was. I mean, so in a sense, there is an imperative that comes, a moral imperative that comes with greater self-awareness that you now have to sort of act in the light of this knowledge. Yeah.
It was a bit like we were talking earlier about science. If a scientist suddenly saw that he could develop this thing that could have enormous negative effects for humanity or the planet. We were talking before that many people said, well, no, science is pure. I'm just following the purity of science. But does that person have a moral responsibility to perhaps not pursue that hypothesis?
It's a great question. And in real life, it's rarely that kind of clean cut, though, yeah. Because there's so many mediations between different knowledges and results in the world. But that being said, yeah, if you have a foreseeable negative consequence, yeah, in light of what we were just talking about, I think it behooves you, now it becomes a responsibility to take that into account. And that may mean that you actually, you know, that Francis Bacon talked about this in The New Atlantis, that when we come up with stuff that we think will be bad for society, we just keep it secret, he says. And that may be a pretty good ethic of science in those cases.
And then what about even-handedness? I'm thinking there are many religions and philosophies of the past that have started off seeing themselves as liberations from previous dogmas, but in doing so set up new ones, because whilst denying one set of dogmatic assumptions, they have assumed other opposing ones. You know, I'm thinking, for example, in Christianity, Islam, Marxism, utilitarianism, postmodernism, you name it.
Yeah, I mean, I call this the itch for certainty, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I'm stealing that from somebody, but that is really dangerous. And I think it's maybe built into our psychology that we just can't handle ambiguity and complexity at a certain level. And we want to reduce things down to simples and black and whites and ins and outs and us versus them. And that dogmatism is an ongoing danger. And I think that one of the key roles, again, pointing to Socrates and his gadfly, you know, role, is to jolt us out of the simple-minded thinking, you know. But again, there's probably a doctrine of the mean to be applied to that, because sometimes you do have to act, and sometimes you do have to draw lines and make distinctions.
Sure.
And it becomes a matter of judgment, right?
Yeah. And that just raised an interesting question for me there, Adam. Do you think that philosophy is a practice that can aid a tolerance of ambiguity? You use the word dirty, messy. You are in there at the coalface of life with philosophy, and it's in ambiguous nature. You know, along with the arts, isn't philosophy something that cultivates that tolerance?
Yeah, I think it is. At some of its best times, that's one of the things it does. And I'm starting to learn that about teaching philosophy. I used to feel really good after a class when I felt like I had tied it all up and sort of made sense of it all. But now I tend to feel better after classes when I'm left wondering, how does that connect to that? And, you know, what was the result of that conversation? And I know my students have that same kind of muddle as well. But being in that muddle, then you're sort of habituating yourself to it and getting comfortable with it. That's true.
And then should it also be valued for creativity and originality rather than just immersing itself in existing discourse?
Oh, definitely. I mean, maybe even above all, I like that point a lot. Because what you're trying to do is snap people out of an ordinary everyday consciousness. You know, that's what you get so easily ingrained into. And really the power of art and maybe really good philosophy is to let a deeper truth shine forth. And science does this too, you know? If you really start thinking about those two black holes that just smashed into each other and sent a gravitational wave through time, space, it's mind-blowing because it takes you out of that ordinary consciousness. And I think that good philosophy does that too.
Yeah. Okay, so given all that, Adam, what responsibility to society does or should philosophy have, and what is philosophy good for?
Well, you know, I say that what we need is a people's philosophy that reserves every right to be unpopular. You know, we have a responsibility to engage with the issues that are important to our society, but that does not mean that we have a responsibility to tell anybody the answers that they want to hear.
That's great. Okay, and perhaps in relation to this, what is your understanding of the middle way, if any, in relation to what we've been talking about today?
Well, that would, I think that you'd have to start a new conversation because you have to teach me about that. I don't know that
okay.
very well. Yeah.
Well, just in a nutshell, the middle way is the idea that you can arguably make better decisions by avoiding fixed views about things. And it's messy in that middle. And so that I see a lot of congruence between the views that you've been expressing today. And we need analysis, but we also need synthesis. They're both interdependent on each other, and we need theory and we need practice. It's all interconnected. I like the term that your colleague Bob uses, this idea of interdisciplinarity. Is that the right way of expressing it?
Yeah, that's right. That does, the way you're describing it sounds very simpatico with a lot of what we're talking about. That's true.
My last question then, Adam, if people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
Yeah, so head to philosophyimpact.org. That's our website, philosophyimpact.org. We post some things there. We just had a workshop. We have a couple NSF grants. Well, one of them has expired, but one's still going on. And we had a workshop in Washington, D.C. on the question of the broader impacts of research. And it's part of what we call a philosophy of impact, like how does knowledge impact society, and also the impact of philosophy. You know, how does philosophy interact with society? And so you can learn more about that there. That's probably the best place to go.
Okay. Well, it's been great talking to you today, Adam. And, you know, I've really enjoyed our discussion, and I'll continue to follow your work with interest.
All right. Thanks for having me on. This was fun.
You can find out more about Middleway philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.